Tonight on the show, we're going to be hearing from David Harrison. This is going to be part two of my interview where David and I were face-to-face on this one. This is the first time I've had the opportunity to interview somebody face-to-face. And today we're going to be talking about theistic evolution. Welcome to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast. Welcome back, guys. So yeah, today is going to be part two. David Harrison, his website Spark Light Planet. He's also going to be talking about an up-and-coming book that he wrote. It's finished. It's published. And so you're going to want to hear about that. But yeah, today we're going to continue on talking about this idea of theistic evolution. So we're just going to pick right back up where we left off last week. And with that, let's go ahead and jump right in.
Yeah, and going back to really theistic evolution, these are kind of questions I have for them. Is death natural in the way God meant and purposed for humanity, or is death unnatural? Because in naturalistic progressive evolution, death is natural.
It's
the
very
way
natural.
Things are supposed to be. But in the supernatural creation view, death is unnatural. It's unnatural to the planet, to humanity. That's an interesting question. Is the universe and Earth and life the result of great power or great time? Because if God has to use great time, because we can only understand it to be done that way, mm-hmm. is that lessening? You know, he's powerful, but, you know, not that. So that's to me is an interesting question. And does human observation or sight merit the trust and faith in it to overbalance the evidence of supernatural origins? To me, is an interesting
right.
question. And then for me, I just want to emphasize this for my, you know, people who are really exploring this and think it's a stumbling block, whether you're old Earth creation or young Earth creation, throwing out this age as a stumbling block. I think the real war of worldviews is between naturalist materialism, atheism, and supernaturalism. So that's where I'm going to fight and die. I have a lot in common with old Earth creationists, and some like supernatural creation of Adam and Eve. And some of them would hold to a worldwide flood. Some of them wouldn't. But we'll get into, later in Genesis, that's where definitely theistic evolution says local flood only. And they have... To me, this is where we can have the creation argument and go into the Bible, is what does the Bible say about when of creations and how long. There's more of a rock solid argument in the New Testament for global destruction, and the verses on that are pretty solid. Even if you say, you know, the whole world is meaning their local world, not globe, but then when you read the New Testament passages, it's talking about only eight were saved and everyone else perished. That's not true if it's a local flood.
That would be a lie.
That's a lie. And this is actually, I have some great theologian people I follow. They take a supernatural view of the Genesis 6 incursion.
Mm-hmm.
So the sons of God, supernatural beings,
yeah.
came down, cohabitated, had these hybrid kids, Nephilim. A local flood's not going to mess with them. You're a supernatural hybrid being. You're just going to swim out of a local flood.
Well, and you see a rainstorm coming,
you
leave town.
And you have to ask the question, how many people die from local floods today? Not many. I mean, even ancient humans are pretty smart when it comes to floods. You climb to higher ground.
Well, not only that.
So the question of why, you know, how could we have giants after the flood if the flood was just local? We should have gobs of giants after the flood. Not just even a small tribe in Canaan, but giants should be all over the world because the flood didn't wipe out any Nephilim. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does.
That to me is that for those who believe in the supernatural incursion and the Nephilim stuff, but don't believe in a global flood, I think there are some interesting questions for in that realm. So.
You know, and what I would say to that too is, water tends to seek lower ground, right?
Yeah.
It runs downhill. Well, how can you have the floodwaters covering the highest mountains and not be, I mean, you almost have this image of
local floods never
like
cover
this supernatural, you know, glass, you know, and we've got our little local flood filled with water and everything around is bone dry. Otherwise the water would just, and you wouldn't have it covering the highest mountains.
Yeah. Yeah. And the New Testament is very clear on the saving of birds and, you know, why would he need to, you know, take birds and all these different things.
Why would he have to take any animals? I mean, really, if he had a little rowboat and if there happened to have been a few animals nearby that only lived in that one area that could hop in, and other than that, he would be all right.
And this is after the flood, God's covenant with Noah. I find this very interesting. This is verses 21. He says, "Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seedtime and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, daylight shall not cease." Now, he didn't strike down every living creature if there's a local flood.
Right.
I mean,
unless all the animals of the world lived in this one little area.
Yeah, yeah.
So which doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. From the New Testament, this is Luke 17, verses 26 and 27. I'll start with 27. It says, "They were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." No, it didn't. If it was local, it didn't destroy all of evil humanity. Was evil localized in just the Mediterranean area, or were all of humanity evil?
Just that area.
And it says, and in the Old Testament says violence actually seeps into creation. Like, he's like, "I'm going to destroy the animals too because they're getting bad." And this is something that I found interesting is how many judgments upon the earth were there before the flood?
Well, they should just be that. Well, gosh, yeah, let me think on that. Well, we had the judgment of sin.
Mm-hmm. Adam and Eve. When's the second time the earth is cursed?
As far as I can remember, gosh, we just have the flood.
Cain.
Okay, but that wasn't the earth. That was just Cain.
No. It says, "Because of you, the ground is cursed." So, let me pull it up.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. So this is interesting because, let me see if I have this. So this is chapter 4, verses 9 through 10. Let me see if I can find that. Okay, verse 11. "And now you are cursed from the ground which has been opened up to receive your brother's your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you." Okay, so is this just, you know, wherever Cain went, the earth was cursed? Or, you know, is this something that the first murder of an imager of God, does that bring essentially another curse upon the earth or the ground? So that's kind of interesting. And then, you know, in the days of Noah, it talks about, you know, the violence was upon the earth and stuff like that. So here's something interesting is in the fossil record, we have some of the, you know, very microscopic creatures and stuff being fossilized.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the Cambrian explosion.
Yep.
So could that first, the fall, have actually kind of shook creation? Not everything dies, but it's almost like a shockwave goes through creation, and you have these little diatoms and little tiny creatures falling into the sediment and getting fossilized.
And there you get your Cretaceous layer.
And you get your first kind of layer. And then maybe with Cain, before the flood, were there earthquakes? Were there, was basically what I'm trying to get at is, before the flood cataclysm, did we have any other cataclysms? It's quite possible. You know, was the earth, you know, kind of getting ready for the flood thing? Were there some earthquakes?
I didn't say.
You know, was there tectonic activity going on before the actual flood happened? That means you could have hundreds of years of some sedimentary deposits going on before the flood, where you have that bearing of the initial body types kind of thing. So it's just a fascinating way to look at it. The fossil record is not just the flood event. There might have been some catastrophism and some stuff going on before the flood because of the earth falling into that non-sustained state, essentially, of the creator. So that, to me, is kind of fascinating when you look at fossil record stuff.
Mm.
That's a bit of a rabbit trail.
Yeah, we like rabbit trails.
Yes.
what are the other things have we not talked about? You know, going back to the day-age theory, a couple other things I want to just throw in there. In context, when you look at the days of creation, it's yes, yom, day, could mean a longer period of time. It could, but most of the time it shows up in the Bible, it means a 24-hour day. And every time it shows up in the Bible with a number associated with it, so first, second, third, fourth, fifth, it's always a day. Whenever it's used with the words evening or morning, it always means a 24-hour day. And so when you read it in context, there was evening, there was morning, the, which is definite article, the first day, the second day, the third day, it's kind of hard to make those days longer. It's really hard to make that text say anything other than what it really says. If you just read it at face value, nobody's going to come to the table and say, well, those really are long periods of time. Nobody will read that and think that. You have to read it into the text. You have to first have a pre-existing bias, a worldview, and then impose it upon the text. You know, something else is kind of fun to think about too. You know, according to Genesis 1, plants were created on the third day, birds on the fifth day, insects on the sixth day. But we're talking about plants having to survive, 48 to 72 hours without the birds and the bees. Well, if you have long epochs, those plants have nothing to pollinate them for millions and millions of years. You also have plants sitting in the dark. Which is also a problem.
Yeah, this is where I go back to when Jesus acts supernaturally, you see fully formed functioning systems where acts. The water's all the way wine. The ear's all the way healed. And so Adam and Eve are all the way human, fully formed and functioning. Were the ecosystems fully formed and functioning? Size is relative, essentially, to God. So was the cosmos fully formed and functioning? So we know, at least with Earth and ecosystems and geosystems, there's such intricacy and interconnection.
Yes.
That even your old Earth creationists would be like, that was supernaturally put together, because you can't get it by progressive chance steps.
You can't get
ecosystems by progressive chance steps.
No.
So that's why even like an old Earth creationist would be like, that was supernatural, because even the science doesn't fit that.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's interesting. When I was watching a Hugh Ross debate, and I don't have these, so you can do your own research on this. He gave some examples of day used with a number in the Old Testament, referring to an epoch or an age of time. So I have to do some more research on some of that too.
I'll look into that too.
Yeah, and I'll send you the link to that debate I watched. And here's the thing is, guys, we do this part-time because we're enthusiasts of the Bible. We love exploring this stuff. I learn a lot doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's science. Science is the exploration of God's word and world. And but these guys get to do it full time. So that's why I'm like, I don't do too many debates because I have kids crawling all over me preparing for this stuff. whereas, you know, Ken Ham and Hugh Ross don't have that.
This is what they live and breathe. Yeah. And not only that, well, as far as my ministry is concerned, I'm jumping from one subject to the next. I'm studying all these different worldviews.
The apologetics. The,
That's right. The cults, occult, Bible difficulties. I'm kind of all over it. But I'm going to look up what Hugh Ross said there concerning a number associated with the
dead.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. It's interesting.
I have a feeling there's going to be somewhere in there a stretch because I've heard so many different creation speakers say there is no instances of Yom in conjunction with a number, meaning anything other than a day. So I feel like there's going to be a stretch there. I'm going to look into that, and I'm going to see if I can't have that at least. Okay. You guys watching the video, sorry, you're out of luck. You're going to have to look it up. Or you can look into my podcast, because my podcast, at the end, I will put an addendum, and I'll make sure I address that issue.
Yeah. So, and also my notes from our talk will be on that as well.
Oh, yeah.
So you can go into my notes and see where I'm getting some of these.
And that's going to be on my website, right?
Yeah.
We can put it on yours, too. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. It's interesting. I want to read two more verses on Noah and the flood, just from the New Testament. These are fascinating. This is 1 Peter 3:20 through 21. So because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah, when the ark was being prepared in which a few, that is 8 persons, were brought safely through the water, he's likening it to baptism. So he's saying only 8 persons were brought safely through the water. But if that was local, many more people survived that local flood.
They all traveled to that one plot of land for the flood.
Yeah, this is 2 Peter 2:5. And if God did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with 7 others, he brought through the flood, which the Greek word is kataklysmos, which is to inundate upon the world of the ungodly. And then this is cool. This is, again, in 2 Peter 3:5-7. And this is the mockers. They will say, because they want to forget that long ago the heavens and the earth were made by God, made at God's command, supernatural, God's command. And the earth came out of the waters and was made in the waters. Later it was destroyed by the waters of a mighty flood. But God has commanded that this present heaven and earth to remain until the day of judgment. Then they will be set on fire, and the ungodly they will be set on fire, and the ungodly people will be destroyed. So if we're talking about a local event, it's referring to the globe here, when it came in and out of the waters. That happened to the whole globe.
You mean the flat earth? Sorry.
We're not going there today. Check out his other podcast on that.
Right.
The earth came in and out of the waters. It's talking about the globe, not just the local area.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says it was destroyed by the waters of a mighty flood. A mighty local flood? And then here's the thing is, the Noah's flood is all about God's judgment and rescue of humanity.
Correct.
And it's alluded to, the second coming of Christ is tied closely with it. Is the second coming of Christ local? Is it only a judgment of a few wicked people locally?
Or
is it a global event? If the Old Testament and New Testament writers are like, local flood, guys, it's not a strong argument for God's global coming and global judgment of people at the end.
No, it's not.
It falls pretty flat. So the New Testament writers seem to really be taking this as not a local world event, but a global event, and likening it to the coming of Christ, which will deal with all evil.
Right.
The world over. The whole world will be remade. And destroyed in fire.
Right.
The local part of it. So that to me is also a challenge for any theistic evolutionist or even old earth creationist who denies a global cataclysmic kind of event.
Mm-hmm.
Just New Testament writers seem to make pretty clear that they thought, you know, inspired.
And these are inspired writers. This is the Holy Spirit speaking.
Yeah. So maybe there's arguments against this, but I just haven't heard them, you know.
And I'm not sure where a person could go with that. Okay, 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 through 6, knowing this verse that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Okay. A little side note there. You can have this one for free. Peter here is talking about the beginning of creation. And for this, they willfully forget that by the word of God, the heavens were of old and the earth standing out of the water and in the water by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. And then he goes on to talk, I mean, he's comparing this to the end times judgment. I did not copy that entire scripture. It's somewhere else in my notes.
Yeah, and you even get this, like we talked about, after the flood, he says, you know, I've swore the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth. You know, so there's not going to be a local flood in this area ever again.
Right.
That's basically what that would have to mean. And then later in verse 9 of the next chapter, it says, so the waters will never flood the earth again, which is interesting. It's actually interesting in Job. I'll try to find this passage. But Job's friends are talking, and they're referring and said, you know, when God's patience waited, he actually, here it is. So this is Ephes, Job's friend, speaking. And Job 22:15, hast thou marked the old way which wicked men have trodden, who are cut down before their time, whose foundation was overflown with a flood? Who said unto God, depart from us, what can the Almighty do to us or them? So
that's
even
one
in
thing
Job 22:15, it was probably alluding to a global flood.
Uh-huh.
You find this in the Psalms as well, which... this is, they're talking about the power of God. And this is just where I love the whole Bible on this. This is Psalm 29, verse 10. Jehovah, and this is two different translations. Jehovah sits as king at the flood. The word is Malabu, or Mabu. Hebrew's fun. But it's
Hebrew expert.
Jehovah sits as king forever. Or the Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned as king forever. So they're, you know, Jehovah's, and I'm like, is this the flood of Noah they're talking about in Psalm 29? You know, it's very interesting. If he's, it's just talking about local floods, Jehovah sits as Lord over the local floods. Again, how powerful is Jehovah?
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. It completely diminishes God and what he's saying about this flood and also this end time judgment. In fact, here's the verse I was not able to say earlier because I didn't copy it into my notes.
Mm-hmm.
2 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. But the heavens and the earth, let me try that again. But the heavens and the earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. So are we to conclude that this judgment, again, in the end times, this judgment of fire is going to be local, or is it going to be worldwide?
Mm-hmm.
Why would God even take the time to warn us in the Bible about a local fiery judgment? Not only that, but when you look at the promise of this rainbow and the promise to never flood the world again, wouldn't that also make God a liar? If God has flooded locally,
mm-hmm,
all over the world, there's been some pretty nasty local floods.
Yeah.
I've seen a few on smaller scales where a lot of people died, but I've watched, you know, around the world where we'll, you know, there'll be instances of tsunamis and other various types of floods, and they are nasty and a lot of people die. That makes God out to be a liar to say that the flood in Genesis 7 was nothing but a local flood.
Yeah. And one more note on this. This is a counter argument from the Old Earth creationists is there's so much biologic material buried in the sedimentary layers of Earth that it couldn't have been from one, like, kind of massive event. But what they're doing is they're taking the amount of biomaterial that Earth currently sustains and saying there's not enough. You'd have to have, you know, millions of years of biomaterial covered, you know,
right,
that process. Because they're like, there's too much biomaterial. But here's the thing is the pre-flood Earth was not the same as this Earth, if you're a catastrophist.
Mm-hmm.
Today on our planet, we have so much desert. We have massive deserts. Middle of America is a desert. Utah, you know,
right,
through that stretch there. But if you have a super lush planet and small water, small lakes, small seas, but most of the planet is vegetation, is land, you've got it. I heard one evolutionist say we need three times the biomaterial. That's what's buried, is what we have today. With the amount of landform we would have had, with a global continent, more massive, and different atmospheric, so you have much more biomass, then you do have enough biomass to be buried in a and the flood's not just like one, you know, it's a whole
water's
year.
Water's going over here.
A whole year
it's
of
back.
Washing around and ripping stuff up and redepositing it and stuff like that. And if you want an interesting resource on just kind of some flood stuff, Genesis Week with Ian Juby.
Yeah,
He goes into some really interesting details. He has a video out. You can visit his website called Footsteps of the Condemned, where he goes in and shows how, you know, like the flood came in and you've got dinosaur tracks.
Yeah.
And then you have a human following them, quite possibly. And even just the dinosaur tracks, they get buoyed up by water.
Yeah, and a lot of them you don't even see the tail because the tail's floating.
Yeah, and so how these trackways are made in inundation environments back and forth. You know, and you have you have a wave comes in that buries those tracks rapidly. Otherwise, they'd be eroded if they're sitting there for thousands of years and stuff like that. So he has some very cool information on just kind of thinking more about this flood. It wasn't just and we're done. You know, it's very re-earth shaping catastrophic event and. That's one reason I'm a supernaturalist as well, is I see much more evidence for catastrophism in geology than gradualism or uniformitarianism. Sure, there's times between catastrophisms where not a whole lot happens.
Sure.
Is it billions of years between that? I would say there's some pretty good arguments against that with global sedimentary deposits. And very little or no erosion between.
Yeah, and by global, there are sedimentary, or rather, I'll just say strata, that span the distance of a continent. Okay.
Yeah.
In other words, in order for that to lay down,
actually,
you had to have.
There
are cross-continent strata.
Yeah.
In order to lay that down, you have to have that entire area underwater.
Yeah.
Okay, that requires a global flood, basically.
Yeah.
The Cretaceous layer, that actually spans the globe, from what I understand.
Yeah.
That means at one point, the entire world was underwater.
Yeah, and if you're like, well, there could never be a global flood on Earth. Well, scientists are now saying there was a flood on Mars. Mars was almost covered in water at one time. There's just some recent papers coming out on that, water formations on Mars and stuff, and that's fascinating. So, of course, we have a global flood on Mars, but we couldn't have one on Earth.
So it just gets too close to the Bible. We can't have that.
Yeah. I want to move on to a couple more biblical arguments or arguments of theistic or old Earth creation.
Sure.
So one that comes up is, you have two revelations of nature, the specific revelation of the Bible, language, words, God's communicating in what I call human language to us. Then they say nature is a book, But Spike Becerra's, I think it was him, I have this referenced in my blog, did Jesus turn, let me see, let me get this right when I reference it.
So you're referring to the natural theology, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I just did a blog, did Jesus create old wine? And I referenced the blog about the book of nature. Mm-hmm. Nature is not a book. Nature is nature, and we can interpret it in different ways. It's not specific, like mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. revelation of God to us in the Bible.
And we apply our own philosophy to yes. those interpretations.
Yes. So if you said nature is a book, then evolutionists get it right all the time. And so that's, and even a theistic evolutionist wouldn't always agree with a natural progressive evolutionist interpretation of everything from nature. So one example of how we get it wrong, the coelacanth invalidates the fossil record. So the coelacanth disappears about 70 million, 80 years ago, and is assumed extinct.
It's not found yeah. in the successive yeah. so strata going up. It's just totally absent, yeah. and then boom, all of a sudden, here it is, and it's alive.
Yeah, so that means all the fossil record shows you is when a creature was fossilized, not how long it lived before that and not how long it lived after that.
Correct.
And so that to me, invalidates the current interpretation of the fossil record.
Mm-hmm.
And it also points to that dinosaurs may not have gone extinct 70 million years ago, just because that's when they're last fossilized in that time scale,
mm-hmm.
which I don't agree with that time scale. But so it means that humans and dinosaurs could have coexisted according to the fossil record.
Mm-hmm.
Because absence of that fossil doesn't mean absence from the from life.
Absolutely.
And so that's just one area where we read that book of nature and get it wrong. And so that's the book of nature kind of thing doesn't hold up. Another one is the genealogies. Okay, so this is – so what do theistic evolution do with the genealogies? And especially what's called the chronogenealogies, because we have different genealogies given in the Bible, but there's only one given with ages.
Right.
This dude uh-huh. had his son –
it was Genesis 5, and I think Genesis 11 has some more of them.
Yeah.
And you can connect Adam all the way to Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And from Abraham's time, we can actually stake Abraham down at a particular time period.
Yeah.
And now we have a kind of an idea of how old the earth is.
Yeah. So what do theistic evolution and old earth creations do with the genealogies? They do a couple things with them. They say there's gaps.
Mm-hmm.
They reference another place where there's a genealogy and there's a guy and there's several guys between him and another reference person. And the challenge with that is you can have those guys as other sons and stuff. I don't quite get into it. But so even if there's some gaps, you still don't get millions of years for humanity.
You certainly don't.
That's a challenge. So they have to do some telescoping. Which is the next person mentioned isn't actually a son, but it's the guy who took over the family line from the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of their counter arguments. If there's telescoping, there might be gaps in that. It's interesting we see in the genealogies the age is decreasing.
Yeah.
Right. And that actually fits with degenerative evolution theory mm-hmm. really well. J.C. Stanford, in his book Genetic Entropy, goes into that and shows the genetic decay curve fits the age degeneration curve for humanity, which is really interesting. So there's actually some interesting genetic and biological science going on confirming actually the age decreasing. And also just the fact that the fossil record shows greater ancestors. This is the other part of degenerative evolution theory, is almost everything in the fossil record is bigger, better, and stronger, and is expressing optimal genetic expression. The environment was different, and creatures grew bigger, better, and stronger. Cattail reeds that are now, you know, a couple feet tall are 60 feet tall in the fossil record. Dragonflies, 3.
And I think that's also going to account for when you were saying there was more biomass
yeah,
in yeah. the fossil record. Things got bigger. We just know that.
Yeah. The fossil record shows greater ancestors and much more plant and animal diversity.
Mm-hmm.
What we have alive on Earth today is probably about a fourth of all the creatures that have ever been alive. So you see degeneration and extinction.
Yeah.
Happening on a massive scale.
This is not onward and upward. This is downward and...
And less and less. We see speciation to extinction, not speciation to new kinds of creatures.
Right.
So the genealogies, what's interesting is there are extra-biblical genealogies. And this is where I reference a book called After the Flood by Bill Cooper.
Okay.
I've only come across people trying to refute, in his book he talks about dinosaurs and ancient records of dinosaurs. Hmm. And I've come across a Evo Wiki page trying to refute the dinosaur part of that.
Yeah.
But I haven't come across anybody really refuting the genealogies of the Brits, the Celts, and the Saxons that he goes into. These are cultures that didn't have contact with Israel or missionaries when they made these genealogies. The Saxon genealogies go back to Adam. The Brits and the Celts go back to Noah. And these genealogies are pretty close to the biblical time scale. What's interesting is the Saxon genealogies actually are really close to the Septuagint genealogies. The Masoretic genealogies, if taken without gaps, is about a 6,000-year timeline to present. The Septuagint is closer to about an 8,000-year timeline. Why the differences? The Masoretic, so the Septuagint says he had his first son at 170. If you look at the Masoretic same passage, which is the Hebrew Old Testament versus Greek Old Testament, mm-hmm. it says he had him at 70. So it's cutting out 100 years here and there of before he had his first son.
So the Masoretic is the one that said 170.
No, that's the 70.
Oh, that one's the 70. And then the
Septuagint, which is the Greek
The Greek translation
has 170 when he had his first son.
I guess I would tend to lend credibility to the Masoretic text.
Yeah, so the Masoretic has a shorter 6,000-ish year. That's where Usher got his stuff and mm-hmm. where like Answers in Genesis comes down on the 6,000. The Septuagint has about an 8,000. And the After the Flood book, the Saxon genealogies echo the Septuagint, which is interesting, I found. Because the writer is going, he's supporting the Masoretic, and he's like, well, these Saxon guys must have got something wrong because their genealogy is an 8,000-year timeline. And it's like, but that fits the Septuagint. Interesting. So there's some interesting stuff in there. You know, it's still under that 10,000-year, 6,000 to 10,000-year umbrella, mm-hmm. which is why a lot of people say young earthers are 6,000 to 10,000.
Right, right.
So that's interesting for the genealogies. And I haven't come across any refutations of After the Flood's genealogical work from the Brits, the Celts, and Saxons. I've looked for it. I've tried to find people refuting it, and I haven't found anybody refuting that. And if there are, write me at originsunited@gmail.com and let me know. Because I'm open.
Mind if I add something here?
Yeah.
So something that I noticed, and I did a study on this several years back in some other podcast series, but when you're looking at these genealogies, and you guys can look this up yourself, Genesis chapter 5, I think then there's a gap in the genealogies, and not a gap in what we're talking about here, but, you know, then it picks back up in Genesis 11, I think, and then it picks up a little bit later, but listen to this. It says, and the days of Adam after he had begotten Seth were 800 years, and he begot sons and daughters. And the days of Adam, the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. Seth lived 105 years and begot Enos. Seth lived after he begot Enos 807 years and begat sons and daughters. All the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Enos lived 90 years and begat Canaan. Why do I keep going like this? On every single one of these people in the genealogy, it says how old they were when they had the son that we're now going to stake down and then look at their life and how old they lived. And then it says how old they were when they had their son and how old that son lived when that son had their son. And so, in other words, there's nowhere that you can actually push in a gap. There's nowhere where you can stick in extra time periods. And that's a major problem for those who are part of the theistic evolution movement that want to push time into the genealogies. There's really no way to do it. And that is my dog trying to go outside.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I've come across is they have to say there's gaps. They have to say there's telescoping, but they don't find that in the text necessarily. It's derived from outside the text, trying to lay that onto the text, saying, well, there must be telescoping, you know. And even with that, you don't get billions of years necessarily.
Correct.
So.
All right, guys, we're going to stop right here, and next week we'll pick up where we left off. Now, I mentioned during the podcast, David mentioned that Hugh Ross has some arguments to the effect of that there are instances in the Bible where the word yom, you know, day or time, is used in conjunction with an ordinal, a number, where it didn't literally mean a day. Okay, and I searched around on Hugh Ross's website quite a bit. I could not find it, but then I did some more Google searching, and I found somebody who was actually sourcing Hugh Ross, but he didn't say where or, you know, what website page or whatever that he saw this. But he did mention there is, as far as I can see, one scripture in the Bible where the word yom, which is translated day, in Genesis 1, that where that word yom is in conjunction with the word one. So one yom, or one day, one time, and where it actually doesn't literally mean a 24-hour period. And this particular website did cite this scripture. It was like Zechariah, I think 14:26 or something like that. That seems to be sticking in my mind. Whatever the case, he did, thankfully, mention that Dr. Jonathan Sarfati had a pretty in-depth response to that particular passage, which I'm really curious to see. Unfortunately, it's in a book I don't have of Dr. Sarfati's, so I'll have to pick that book up. And while I was reading through this page, there were some really interesting arguments against the young earth creation perspective, and specifically addressing this word yom. And I wouldn't say that these arguments were fairly persuasive, but I think they are arguments that need to be addressed. And so I can see where I'm going to be coming back to the subject at the very least momentarily. Maybe I'll have Dr. Sarfati on. There's plenty to talk to him about. Maybe I'll have him back on, and somewhere in there we'll spend about 15-20 minutes addressing a lot of these arguments, because, yeah, they do sound, especially coming from somebody who speaks as if they have authority and speaks with confidence, they do sound convincing at first. I immediately, as I was reading through them, several of the arguments, I thought, no, that's not going to work. But I'll wait to give you a more thorough explanation here when we have this interview that I'm hoping to have with somebody on this subject. So, be that as it may, we'll leave it at that. Next week, we're going to pick up exactly where we left off here today with David, and next week will be part three, the last part. After that, I've got a whole bunch of interviews lined out. I'm really excited. I mentioned in the past, for example, that I was going to have Shahram Hadian on the show, and that kind of fell through there for a while, but yes, I met him in person, and he has agreed once again. He apologized. He was very busy, and he is going to be coming on the show. I've got a whole bunch of really interesting interviews coming up the road here, already lined out. The problem really now is, who do I interview first, and which ones to put on online first? So I have more people who want to be on the podcast right now than I've ever had before. So it's going to be an interesting next couple of weeks. Anyway, well, stop right there, and I love you guys. See you next week.